way through to the baths he knew. Either Maria had stood just here at some recent moment, or would stand here soon. After getting tangled in the mazes of the parlour, he felt relieved to be standing again on the clear path. A prominent banner above the customs booths advertised a 5% tax on all goods and currency. A second notice promised swift justice to anyone caught smuggling. The tourist at his elbow wore a tall wig, powder white and boastful as a mainsail. His only luggage appeared to be an unlatched alligator skin bag from which a toy poodle peered and yipped. As flamboyant as this man was, he was not remarkable. The crowd was flush with wealthy eccentrics. They carried frilled parasols and crepe bonnets, black thorn canes and gold watch chains. Though better dressed, the behaviour of the mob wasn't much different than the mobs of the market. The arriving masses were aggressive, single-minded and aloof. If he failed to press against the person in line ahead of him, a swifter opportunist would wriggle into the gap. A woman carrying a large hooded birdcage knocked him on his heels, jumping into his line. He felt hemmed in and panicky. He buried his hands in his coat pockets to keep from biting his nails, a nervous habit he had long suppressed. His thoughts kept darting back to Edith, the agonized look on her face, the nurse's sadistic counting, and the repulsive yet familiar smell of searing flesh. He had left her. She'd wanted him to, but that didn't lessen his guilt. His conscience antagonized him.
You left her because you were afraid. You left her because she made you uncomfortable.
And he was. And she had. But what could he have done? What would it have accomplished if he'd stayed and been branded and banned himself? And yet, if he discovered that another man in another ward had abandoned Maria the way he had abandoned Edith, he'd never forgive the scoundrel. For the first time in his life, he had to confront a terrible fact about himself. Yes, he was shy, nervous, and a tad sanctimonious, but these were not his flaws. He was a coward. The tower had proven that much. He was a coward, and Edith had paid the price. After 3 hours of shuffling and self-recriminations, Senlin finally arrived at the front of his line. He only had to wait for the pushy woman with the birdcage to finish answering the agent's well-rehearsed catechism.
Have you any spoilable goods? Do you intend to earn a salary during your time in the baths?
All went smoothly, until the agent asked her to unsheathe the birdcage. She demurred. He insisted. She resolutely refused on the grounds that her bird was extraordinarily sensitive, and she was a well-established lady with a husband who possessed nearly supernatural political powers. The mood of the agent soured visibly, the dark bill of his cap dipping over his eyes like a heavy, humourless brow. At some discreet signal, another agent appeared, blocking the woman's passage. This agent did not hesitate in removing the birdcage cover, prettily printed with yellow flowers. He didn't seem at all surprised to discover that there was no bird. The cage was stuffed with banknotes. It must have contained hundreds of minas, a small fortune. Senlin couldn't help but gape. The woman's bluster quickly turned to fawning. She battered her heavily charcoaled eyes and twisted her sharp hips flirtatiously. It was a grotesque display. Unmoved, the agent hooked her arm and escorted her away. As her voice receded, it rose into the higher octaves of panic. Senlin thought of the torment that awaited her, and his hair stood on end. Then Senlin was shoved forward into the chute, and the agent asked what he had to declare. Without a second thought, he emptied the coins from his pockets and removed his boots so he could unpack the thin stack of large paper notes hidden there. He laid out his pitiful fortune. 6 minas and 20 shekels in all. He dutifully submitted 5% into the agent's open hand. When asked to present his bag for inspection, he quickly complied. His copy of the Everyman's Guide slid about at the bottom of his otherwise empty satchel.
"I was robbed," he explained. This information seemed to make no impression on the unsmiling agent.
He directed Senlin through the doors at the end of the tunnel with a quick swing of his chin. Feeling as if he was stepping from a riot, Senlin staggered into the shattered sunlight of the baths. The light
was simply dazzling. It took him a moment to discern how sunlight had been funneled into the cavern that held the city of the baths. All about the top of the chamber, rectangular vents beamed in light. "The shafts must be hundreds of feet long," Senlin murmured. He could only imagine the contrivance of mirrors such a feat required. The light was further dispersed by scores of mirror balls, some as large as a carriage, which hung suspended from the blue-painted ceiling high above. The effect reminded him of how the sun lit the walls of a tidal cave by bouncing off the water. Everything here spangled and rippled. It was beautiful. On either side of the cobbled pedestrian mall, three- and four-story buildings stood without so much as an alley between them. The pastel facades were finished with elaborate white cornices, making the buildings look like decorated cakes. There were playhouses, dance halls, restaurants, and hotels. The tourists were dressed in the diverse fashions of their native states, some in short riding jackets and breeches, some in elaborate kimonos, some in togas and leather thongs. Yet even among this chic flow, Senlin occasionally spied the bare backs and shaved heads of the hods, stooped and shuffling under heavy jute baskets. Customs agents, half escorted, half drove these eyesores through the flocks of wealthy tourists, who scattered before the hods as if fearing infection. Senlin realized that he hadn't seen any hods in the parlor. He wondered how they had progressed unseen to the third floor. He recalled Gold's remark that the tower was not without back doors. Perhaps the hods traveled a less public road. He doubted it could be a very pleasant thoroughfare. The wide avenue dead-ended into a reservoir that was perfectly round and blue as a sapphire. The size of the body of water was staggering, and Senlin wondered whether it had been drawn up from the deep aquifers beneath the tower, or drawn down from the clouds that continuously mussed the highest reaches of the tower. Farther out from shore, reeds with white downy seeds grew. Flocks of pale flamingos preened and squawked amid the tall grass. At the center of the reservoir, a tower spiraled up to the ceiling, tapering like a conch shell as it rose. Hyacinth and ivy poured from portals and windows and clung to every surface. Steam wriggled through the greenery. Wrought-iron pedestrian bridges spoked out from the steaming tower, connecting it to the shoreline. Arched signs over the bridges advertised, "One shekel to visit the famous fountain spas." The reservoir, obviously the main attraction, was encircled by bathhouses. The cobbled, artificial shore teemed with bathers, young and old. At intervals in the deepening water, mechanical hippopotamuses opened and closed their maws, shooting jets of water from their throats, to the great amusement of many children. This was the wondrous tower Senlin had expected to see, a place befitting a honeymoon. He had underestimated the squalor and danger of the lower ringdoms, but equally, he'd underestimated the beauty of the baths. It was glorious. He only wished that he could share this moment of revelation with Maria. It would have made her so glad to see it. Senlin moved along the water's edge, winding a path through picnickers, lounge chairs, and cabanas. The air smelled strongly of a dozen different soaps. The fragrances itched his nose. Out of habit, his eyes darted toward any swath of red. It was absurd to think that she would always wear it, and perhaps the hat had been stolen. He liked to think that she was presently situated in a hotel suite, comfortably arranged and waiting, perhaps even at that moment standing on a balcony, looking out over the tideless coast, thinking of him. Perhaps she'd found a piano and was entertaining the other guests with her fierce playing and thrilling voice.
"That is the face of a man who needs a welcome." The mirthful baritone startled Senlin.
He looked down and realized that he was standing very near a slatted lounge chair, holding a large and barrel-chested bather.
"Welcome to the baths!"
The man was bronze-skinned and shirtless, wearing nothing but red bathing trunks and darkly smoked glasses. A two-pointed black beard accentuated his iron-gray mane of hair. He seemed hale and athletic for a man his age. Senlin was a little intimidated by the width of his chest and shoulders, though his smile seemed amiable enough.
"And that is the dazed look of a man fresh from the monkey pen."
He gave an exaggerated shudder.
The parlour is an awful place.
Despite his heightened suspicion of all the tower's visitors, Senlin couldn't help but to feel an immediate camaraderie with this grinning giant. He asked the question that had been gnawing at him since he'd left Seth at the bottom of the parlour stairs. Are they all actors?
I don't know. Perhaps they're just prigs. In the end, does it matter? They are terrible, and you are rid of them. Well, you are physically rid of them. It may take a bottle of wine to purge yourself spiritually, or, if you're very traumatized, a fortnight in the steam baths.
Senlin pointed his bony chin at the fountain spire.
It's an incredible sight, but I don't think I'll be staying as long as a fortnight.
Ah, no, me neither. I leave tomorrow, homeward bound.
The giant briefly described his background in mining, mostly in the Sion Mountains to the north, though Senlin did not imagine, based on the man's appearance, that he had spent much time in the bowels of the earth, scrounging after glimmers in the dark. He seemed more the type to count the gold than to dig after it.
And you, I take it, are...
The giant gave Senlin a long, appraising look.
Mortician.
Senlin laughed. Headmaster.
Of course. All in black because you're mourning the loss of youthful innocence.
His deep bellow was half reverent and half joking. Senlin would soon discover it was a tone he used often, an ironic bark.
A man of letters. Good. I haven't had a reasonable conversation in months. Everyone here is too stuffy or witty to let an honest word slip out. I'm rabid for some intelligent discourse. Let's meet this evening at Café Risso for tea or drinks or dinner or whatever it is you scholars indulge in.
The café, the man indicated, was located on the waterfront just behind them.
Risso's service is slow, but the snails are delicious.
Though Senlin was hesitant to set any engagements, in case he was reunited with Maria in the next few hours, the happy Titan wouldn't accept his excuses, and promised that the engagement would be educative at worst and enjoyable at best. Eventually, Senlin accepted the invitation, and before they parted, the two introduced themselves formally. Senlin shook the hand of John Taru, who laughed robustly when Senlin asked for a hotel recommendation.
They're all the same, Headmaster. They're overrun with luxurious moths that never tire of eating your money. Send a letter to your bank before you ask for a room with a view.
Encouraged by his encounter with the friendly Taru, Senlin went in search of Maria. He quickly decided to focus his attention on the numerous hotels and the customs gate. If she was already here, she would have hired a room, and if she was still mired in the bowels of the tower, the only escape was by the customs gate. He would catch her coming or going. He wished again that he'd had the foresight to negotiate a hotel reservation. As things stood, he'd have to scour the panoply of hotels. There were nearly 60 in all. Adding to the difficulty, he would have to hunt for Maria discreetly. He couldn't just ramble about confessing that he'd lost his wife. He hadn't forgotten Finn Gol's advice to look without appearing to look. He didn't want to attract the attention of thieves or hucksters. Even Taru, amiable as he seemed, would have to earn his trust. So he devised a surreptitious means of discovering whether Maria was presently staying in a hotel. He approached the concierge as if he meant to check in and needed only to confirm that his wife, returned early from a matinee, had not already done so. When the concierge returned with the news that no guests under his name were currently on their rolls, Senlin would feign puzzlement and say, "This is the Mongrove Hotel," knowing full well it wasn't, because he had just come from the Mongrove next door. His mistake would be corrected, and he'd be sent on his way, just another absent-minded tourist who had misplaced his hotel, but not his wife. Soon, Senlin had inquired in 24 hotels. Though he'd still found no sign of Maria, he felt comforted by the fair start he had made. It would be a process. He had to be patient. He was on the street between hotels when a carillon chimed a pretty musical phrase and then rang the hour of 5. Recalling his engagement with John Taru,
He made his way back to the Café Riso with a rapidly growing appetite. It had been days since he'd had a proper meal, and the prospect was quite appealing. Besides, he hoped he might learn something useful from a man who seemed in every way at home in the baths. He found Taru sitting at a wrought-iron table on the patio outside Café Riso, a wine glass and a bottle in front of him. Enclosed by a low fence, the patio contained an archipelago of wrought-iron tables and chairs. A few solitary diners sat engrossed by the reservoir, which was turning orange and purple in the refractions of the setting sun. An artist stood at an easel nearby, blending paint on his palette. It seemed an ideal hour for meditation. Senlin greeted his new friend, who had added a canary yellow shirt to his red swimming trunks. His flamboyant style amused Senlin, but it seemed to be the local mode. Everyone dressed like actors in a travelling theatre troupe. Taru looked at Senlin distantly, as if he were a stranger who'd wandered into view. Senlin felt a flush of embarrassment. He had misinterpreted the man's politeness for a sincere offer of friendship. Gaul had warned him. A man had no friends in the tower. He was a fool to hope otherwise. Senlin was about to dart back out into the street when Taru abruptly emerged from his trance.
"Headmaster! No, don't go. You only surprised me. I was walking down a road 1,000 miles away."
He rubbed his face vigorously.
"Mud it. This ghostly light makes the mind wander."
Taru coaxed and flattered Senlin into the chair across from him, smiling over the prongs of his black beard. A young woman in a red apron appeared with a second glass. Taru made a show of ordering their dinner, bantering flirtatiously with the server as he did. He ordered the snails and lamb, potatoes and stewed dates besides, and then turned the empty bottle upside down over his head and said,
"My brains are going dry,"
at which the server giggled. She quickly returned with a full, uncorked bottle. Soon the siphon sunlight dimmed and was replaced by a silvery cast of much paler moonlight. Senlin's face felt warm with wine, and his stomach was round with excellent food. Their plates were cleared, a bottle of port was brought, and they turned their chairs to face the dark water that flashed like cracked onyx. The painter closed up his easel. Gas lamps along the streets and pedestrian bridges were lit. Music from the dance halls mingled in the distance. A woman's laughter reverberated from a hotel terrace behind them. Senlin wished again to have Maria with him, though if she were there, she would almost certainly pull him from his chair and chase him to the nearest dance hall. Though their conversation during dinner had been eclipsed by their appetite, the two men now began speaking with the ease of old friends.
"And there are no peacocks?" Senlin asked.
"There are 2 flamingos for every man, and thousands of finches and parrots and swallows and doves, and I've heard of an eccentric who walks a dodo on a leash, but I've never seen a peacock."
Senlin laughed.
"I met someone who was certain there were peacocks."
"I'm suspicious of people who are certain. I've known men who say that, without a shadow of a doubt, the tower contains 46 ringdoms. They'd start fistfights over this undeniable fact."
Taru sucked his teeth.
"And I've also met seemingly sincere airmen who swore the tower had only 32 ringdoms.
Taru tapped his nose.
"I know the truth. The tower is only as tall as the man that climbs it."
"To uncertainty,"
Senlin offered by way of toast, and Taru raised his glass.
"If there are no peacocks, there must be lamb, at least. That was one of the sweetest chops I've ever tasted."
"There's no room in the baths for lambs, unless you count the herds of courtesans flouncing around in those horrible wool wigs. You've seen them. Every one of them, I promise you, is hopping with lice."
Taru went on to explain that most perishable delicacies were carried up on airships, which was also the most popular passage for tourists.
"It's only the adventurous and the frugal who climb the tower by foot," Taru said,
causing Senlin to feel self-conscious about his livelihood. He imagined that to Taru, who he'd learned owned 3 mines, one of which produced emeralds, teaching children to read, write, and multiply must seem a rather lowly living.
"Don't scowl, headmaster. So the lamb flies while you climb. You are no lamb. You have mettle and wit. Everyone else here is softer, dumber, and poorer than they pretend to be. They're all pig farmers and grocers in royal drag."
Taru wrapped his napkin about his head like a turban. It made Senlin laugh.
"I'm sorry that you're leaving, Taru. It's refreshing to have good company."
"Nah, it can't be helped. To tell the truth, I've delayed my homecoming too long. My wife will have sold off all of my possessions."
"You're married?" Senlin was surprised.
28? No, 29 years. Though between us, it feels not a day more than 30. She's a patient woman, but I have made her wait too long."
Finding that Taru was married only endeared him to Senlin more, though he wondered why a man in the prime of his middle age would come to the baths without his wife. Such a separation seemed to make a question of love and marriage. Why marry if you are going to walk the wonders of the world alone? Though Senlin had to admit, that was exactly what he had done. Chapter 2 The only real danger is of growing so relaxed that one falls asleep while soaking in a bath. To prevent accidental drowning, go with a companion or seek out a new friend. Every Man's Guide to the Tower of Babel. Days passed. A regular schedule emerged, which was a comfort to Senlin. Mornings were spent discreetly searching hotel registries for signs of Maria. When Senlin felt panic creeping in, he reminded himself that Maria was resourceful, he was patient, and the tower was finite. He read the guide, his only book. He searched its many platitudes for practical advice and found little. He wished he had brought more books. When these consolations failed, he fortified himself with a glass of wine. Days passed. It wasn't long before he found his way behind the cake-decorated hotels and galleries to the narrower alleys where the porters, maids, and vendors lived. Those cloistered avenues were not slums exactly, but they were generally humble and often run down. Shutters hung unevenly from glassless windows, and laundry lines sutured the alleyways. The air was muggy with human scents. The reflected sunlight was dimmer here, too, which allowed lichen to bloom on the plaster walls and cobblestones, turning them slick and spongy and grey-green. Among the tenement apartments were boarding houses, which could be hired short-term and on short notice. An effective search of the boarding houses was difficult because they were disorganized, overcrowded, and often run by suspicious, unhelpful proprietors. Senlin felt conspicuous and unwelcome in the back alleys of the baths, and it wasn't long before he found excuses to avoid searching them. After all, he doubted very much that Maria would have to resort to such drab and unsafe accommodations. Days passed, and the trauma of the parlor dwindled in his memory. He had all but convinced himself that Edith had recovered and found her way home. The fall harvest wasn't too far off. The generaless, he liked to think, had overcome her allergy and reclaimed her command. She would always carry the scar, the parlor's brand, but she would enjoy a full and long life, far from the shadow of the tower. He took his lunch outside the customs gate, where it was relatively easy to pass unnoticed amid the wash of tourists. Ever since his first exposure to the customs agents, he had been careful to avoid attracting their attention. It wasn't easy. The navy-coated agents were everywhere. They marched under the orders of someone called the Commissioner, who was often discussed, yet seldom seen in public. Otherwise, the rule of law was a mystery to him. Truthfully, he hoped it would remain one. The Everyman's Guide said nothing substantive about the laws of the baths, but he wanted to believe the baths was a more civil ringdom than the basement or the parlour. He wasn't looking for evidence to the contrary. But the evidence, he'd soon discover, was inescapable. In the evenings, he dined with John Taru.
Taru had failed to follow through on his promise to leave in the morning, and Senlin soon understood that it was a kind of daily homage he paid his wife. Taru was always preparing to depart for home. Senlin continued to keep his situation to himself, though it increasingly seemed ridiculous. And still, he could never quite bring himself to confess to Taru that he in fact had a wife, and that he had lost her. Perhaps his discretion had turned to paranoia. Perhaps he treasured Taru's ignorance. So long as he didn't speak of Maria, they could laugh, bicker, philosophize, and drink. If not for these distractions, Senlin would have to face the dread that was ballooning inside of him. The dread was already as stubborn as a wine stain and as pervasive as a chill. Suppose Maria never came? Suppose she had found a way home without their train tickets? Suppose she was injured, or captured, or worse? But the dread abated in Café Risso, where Taru's ironic bark reigned supreme. When Taru was not at the café, he could often be found lounging in his usual rented chair by the water, not far from where a clockwork hippopotamus spit its elegant jet.
"Today is no good for travel, headmaster. The winds are coming in from the north. If I try to fly home, I'd end up at the South Pole," Taru said, from behind his dark glasses.
The exquisite glare of the afternoon sun seemed magnified rather than reflected by the mirror balls twisting overhead. Senlin had been roaming the baths for more than 2 weeks and still hadn't grown accustomed to the shattered light, or how it sometimes dimmed when clouds passed unseen over the sun outside.
"Are you all done with your mysterious errands or ablutions or whatever it is you fritter your days on?"
"Only taking a break."
Senlin waved a hand before his face, shooing the question away. In truth, he doubted Taru really cared to know. The giant just enjoyed teasing him. Senlin paid an attendant a half shekel to rent the slat-backed chair beside his friend. In his long dark coat, Senlin stood out among the tourists in bathing suits, though there was one other awkwardly dressed gentleman fidgeting not far from them. Taru nodded discreetly toward the nervous man.
"I have been watching this performance all morning. I think you've arrived just in time to see the end of this little tragedy," Taru said.
The man in question was pudgy, middle-aged, and wore the farcical regalia of an admiral. Gold-threaded epaulets, a purple sash, and a three-cornered hat. The well-fed and well-groomed man paced at the water's edge, more like a cornered mouse than a military commander.
"He is flat broke. They always are, and terribly in debt," Taru said from the corner of his mouth. "And still, he has carefully preserved his most ostentatious costume. Here is your peacock, headmaster, but watch."
A few moments later, a detail of 6 customs agents appeared. Clubs and rapiers wagged from their wide, polished belts. The last agent dragged a basket heaped with coal. The agents surrounded the merchant, who immediately began dithering about the misapplication of justice, his powerful connections, and his reversing fortunes. He hopped from foot to foot, his arms raised, as if he were trying to waltz through the circled agents. Unmoved, the agents grabbed him and began roughly stripping him of his clothes. Horrified, Senlin moved to interject, but Taru was quick to grab his arm and anchor him to his chair. Taru put his finger to his lips and gave Senlin a severe look of caution. Now cowering in his stretched and stained long underwear, the man wept while 2 agents shaved his head first with rusty shears and then a notched straight edge. While they worked, another agent aired the man's name, described the exact nature and size of his debts, and announced how long he would have to work as a hod to level his accounts. 12 years! 12 years! A whole era of a man's life lost. For what? An overdrawn account? It seemed out of proportion. The disgraced man sobbed through the judgment as nicks in his scalp welled with blood. At the conclusion of his sentence, the commissioner's authority was invoked, and a heavy cuff was locked around his neck. A 6-inch iron tube dangled from the collar like a pendant. The agent rolled up the man's sentence and stuffed it into the tube, screwing the cap closed behind it.
The freshly initiated Hod was forced to pick up the load of coal, then escorted away.
"Where does he go?" Selin asked.
"There is a passage that is only swept by the feet of Hods. It's called the Old Vein, and it coils through the walls of the tower, an unlit and unaired crag. It is more dangerous, I'm told, than any mine a man ever dug. Pray you never see it."
Taru spoke in a low, dour tone.
"That plucked peacock will not survive 12 years. He may not even survive the night." "It is a lesson, Headmaster Tom," Taru said. "Be mindful of your debts."
Senlin put a fingernail between his teeth.
"But surely this isn't a common occurrence?"
"As common as the Hods themselves."
Despite the vivid reminder that neither his time nor funds were infinite, Senlin began to detect an ebb in the urgency of his search. Something about the beauty and ease of the environment anesthetized his dread, and made the episode with the Hod seem outrageous. A few days later, he completed his 10th circuit of the Baths hotels. Most of the concierges had long ago seen through his ruse, or had given up pretending to be fooled. When they saw him coming, they gave a quick shake of their head, and off he went to the next stop on his regular route. Sometimes he would dally under the window of a concert hall, listening to the merry refrains of a brass band. Sometimes he watched the children romp about the shoreline, and thought of the coming school year. The school and his duties seemed somehow unreal and unimportant. He'd lost the will to read. He'd still hold the guide between his tightly pinched bony fingers, and would set his eyes firmly upon the page. But then his mind would just slide off into fantasy. He'd envision the moment of their reunion. He dreamt up many versions of the scene while he loitered on the curbs outside customs, waiting for her to walk by with her arms swinging, or with a book to her face, or singing a pub song. In some versions of these fantasies, the two of them crashed together like cymbals, and right there, in front of everyone, he held her neck and kissed her. Meanwhile, Taru played the merry friend. Taru's indulgence was contagious, though, in all fairness to him, Taru wouldn't call it indulgence. He would call it reason.
"You're in the baths, and yet you have never been to the fountain? That's like climbing a mountain and refusing to look at the view, Headmaster. Be reasonable."
When Senlin finally acquiesced, paid the shekel, and went to the fountain, he discovered that, after a few moments spent soaking in a tub, there was not a thought in his head. His feelings of dread just steamed away. The fountain, that garden spire that rose from the heart of the reservoir, was a true marvel of plumbing. The tiled interior was filled with aromatic steam, thick as ocean fog. Pipes and troughs moved water between hundreds of white marble tubs, installed one over the other like the scales of a pine cone. The higher a tub was inside the spire, the more challenging it was for a bather to reach it. One had to climb by ladder and ledge and narrow step. Spillage from one tub cascaded onto the lower tiers like a champagne fountain. The rain of condensation and displaced water was constant, yet pleasant. Where the water was drawn from, or how it was heated, was a mystery that Senlin puzzled over once or twice. No one else seemed to give the question much thought. Soon, neither did he. Knowing that the fountain was the one spot everyone visited, it was, after all, the only place to take a hot bath, Senlin glanced about for Maria, though discreetly and sleepily. Later, when they were out of the fountain spire and the fog had cleared from his mind, he wondered if his search was any better than the lip service Taru paid his wife. Was Maria really likely to be frittering time in a tub while lost in a strange land? Was she even in the baths? For all he knew, she might still be stuck in the Mayfair nightmare, dutifully playing another man's wife. Perhaps she was lying in the beer slurry of a basement gutter, or maybe she was camping at the site of their parting in the ever-changing market. He wished he could be certain. He should be more certain. He should know his own wife better.
Senlin's lodgings did not include a window, or a sink, or a writing desk, but even so, the room was a drain on his resources. His meals with Taru weren't without expense either, and then there were his occasional soaks to pay for. After a month, he calculated he could only afford to stay 10 days more, 2 weeks if he gave up drinking wine in the evening with Taru, which suddenly seemed a great inconvenience. This budding sense of entitlement horrified him. But such was the tower's effect. First, it turned luxury into necessity, and then the tower conspired to revoke all claims to happiness, dignity, and liberty. This perverse metamorphosis, from tourist to royalty to hod, plagued Senlin's imagination. His dread returned with greater force. He could not sleep for days, and then, finally, when he collapsed into an exhaustion, he dreamt horrible dreams. Before his sleeping gaze, the peacock man was again stripped of his admiral's costume. Hunched under a great basket of coal, the wretch joined a river of wretches climbing the jagged old vein. In this dream, Senlin scoured the hobbling and gaunt procession of hods for Maria, willing, at once, for her face to emerge, and at the same time fearing that it would. As his sheets began to thicken with sweat, he followed the line of bald backs and knuckled spines up the infinite tower for weeks, for years. When the plucked peacock finally collapsed, his exhausted heart bulging like a tumour from his ribcage, Senlin, forgetting that he was not one of them, forgetting his search for his wife and his old yearning for home, bent down and took up the load. Chapter 3 Even beauty diminishes with study. It is better to glance than gawk. Every Man's Guide to the Tower of Babel. The bell above the door jingled. The post office was as small as a closet, but as high as a silo. The postal clerk, who sat behind a caged window in a seamless marble wall, looked like a swept-up pile of dust. His collar, though buttoned to the last, rattled emptily about his skeletal neck. He sat scribbling, the scratch, scritch, scratch of his pen-nib constant and grating. Other than a wooden writing podium, the post office was bare. Senlin asked the clerk for a sheet of stationery and a nib to write with. The request interrupted the clerk's scribbling, and Senlin could see through the bars that the clerk was systematically blacking out the words in a chapbook, starting from the back and working to the front. As soon as the clerk had taken Senlin's coin and given him his sheet of stationery, he returned to his methodical, obnoxious scratching. Feeling a little disquieted, Senlin went to the podium and began to compose his letter. He did not deliberate. He'd written and revised the letter a dozen times over in his mind while lying amid his knotted sheets that morning. Dear Ms. Olivet Burks, I know you will be relieved to hear that all is well, and we are enjoying our honeymoon in the baths. The snails here are quite delicious, and they remind me fondly of the periwinkles back home. We are enjoying ourselves so thoroughly, in fact, that we have decided to extend our holiday a few weeks more. As my kin, I am writing to request your assistance in preparing for the eventuality of my delayed return. The school year will commence in 4 weeks, and so I humbly ask that you use your considerable influence to lead the town in selecting a fitting substitute in my absence. This is not a resignation, but merely a request for an extension of Esau's goodwill. I shall return with Maria before the end of harvest. Your loving cousin, Thomas Senlin. P.S. I am aware that you warned Maria against accepting my proposal, and I hold no grudge in the matter. She is a treasure. I strive every day to be deserving of your confidence, and so remain ever your faithful friend and servant, T.S. He folded, addressed, and sealed the letter with the post officer's wax and signet. He paid the dust-pile clerk a shekel more to post the letter. Again, the clerk only halted his scrawling long enough to take Senlin's money and to shove the letter into a slit in the wall behind him, before he resumed his work on the vanishing chapbook. Watching the mail slot gulp his letter, it occurred to Senlin that the chute might empty into a fire pit, and he'd never know it. This realization of his helplessness filled him with a sudden fit of pique, and he said,
"I'll buy that book you're ruining for another shekel,"
before he knew why he'd said it. The clerk shrugged and slid the half-blacked-out chapbook under the bars without ever having uttered a word. Returning to the street, Senlin resumed his usual route, reading the chapbook as he walked. He continued in this way, dazedly walking and reading, until the work so absorbed him that he had to remove himself from the impatient pedestrian traffic and perch upon a shoreline bench. There, he finished what he hoped was a work of maudlin fiction. It certainly couldn't be true.
The Confidences of a Wifemonger by Anon. A wifemonger, simply put, is a man who identifies, isolates, primps, and delivers women who are fit for wifedom to willing and wealthy gentlemen. A competent wifemonger will have no fewer than 3, and no more than 6 women in his charge. Fewer than 3 prospects and gentlemen will feel starved for option, and more than 6 will make would-be husbands suspect they have blundered upon a harem. Identifying the would-be wife. The Tower of Babel is lousy with waifs, but princesses are in scarce supply. A wifemonger will spend most of his time spotting wifely talents among the feminine masses. Mongers anticipate 3 essential virtues of their wives-in-waiting. Virtue 1. Healthy. Wives must be fertile and free of disease, lice, and deformity. Ugliness is naturally considered a deformity. Personal experience suggests that 70% of the female population fails to embody the first virtue. The gentle reader will be unsurprised to learn that 95% of would-be husbands might graciously be described as unhealthy. Virtue 2. Wholesome. Wholesomeness is less a positive force than the resistance of a negative quality. Or, in the parlance of my profession, floozies make bad wivesies. While husbands would, of course, prefer to be joined with an unblemished woman, a wife need not be a virgin so long as she maintains some vestige of innocence, modesty, or, at the very least, coyness. Mothers, of course, are excluded out of hand. Of the remaining Babella stock, 1 out of 2 women will be suitably whole. Husbands-to-be, of course, remain whole regardless of how many partners they've broken in half, quarters, or eighths. Virtue 3. Charming. Charm is perhaps the most elusive of virtues, and many a wifemonger has been ruined by his inability to judge a woman's charm. Novice mongers often confuse the bosom for charm. Charm, in my experience, is necessarily mysterious. Charming women will leave their masculine audience with questions. If the woman installs no curiosity or confusion in the man, then no charm exists in the woman. Men with the least amount of personal charm are most devoted to this quality in their spouses. Isolating the would-be wife. Once a wifemonger has identified bona fide bridal material, he must separate her from the influences of kin, friends, compatriots, colleagues, peers, and all familiar influence. This process, referred to as stabling, is generally successful when the subject is in some distress. Experienced mongers don't try to separate a wife in potentia from a spouse or a father. Instead, they prey upon the wandering souls, the lost, the destitute, and the desperate. When a woman has already confronted the inevitability of her ruin, she is much easier to separate from any lingering feelings of hope. If the woman is sufficiently terrorized, it may not even be necessary to lie to her. It will probably be necessary to lie to her. Common lies include, "This man is a ship captain whose trade route will carry him near your home," and "This fine gentleman is a baron, registrar, port authority, and will hold you as his sister until your family can be found," and "This man has been hired by your loved ones to whisk you back to your old bedroom, still exactly preserved, with your wildflowers pressed in your encyclopedias,
and your slippers under the bedside, etc., etc. Under the guise of charity, a desperate woman can be convinced to accompany even the most buffoonish, malformed, and tiresome mate back to his princely hovel. Primping the would-be wife. Avoid the colour red when buying dresses for your stabled wives. It is a lurid colour and suggests a sexual aggressiveness that may intimidate the pseudo-functional male. Avoid white frocks as well, as these infer a prudishness that does not appeal to the libido of men who are incapable of attracting a mate naturally. Avoid black, too. It suggests severity and independence. Blues, pinks, and yellows are generally appealing to the stunted tastes of the hunchback gnomes who slink down from their filth-crusted birdcages and ignoble bloodlines to prey upon unguarded innocence. If your would-be wife is roughly mannered or shy at conversing, or afflicted with an unusual laugh, do your best to gently train her away from these habits. It is vital that you earn her trust and learn as much about her as possible. The wife-monger must cast lingering glances and lingering praises. Make your evenings long with her. Make elaborate promises. Expound on their elaborateness until you are swearing on your own head and by your own grave. Avoid, at all costs, falling in love with a woman in your stable. Do not forget, you are a wretched man, a monster worse than the lecherous princes that slide down the Tower of Babela like dung down a camel's leg. Avoid, at all costs, falling in love. The door to ruin is heart-shaped and ringed with stone roses. The remainder of the book was blacked out. It was a fiction, surely, a crude romance written by a cynical man who'd been rejected by his lover. There was no conspiracy to trap defenseless women in unhappy marriages. This was the Tower of Babel. And though he knew it was not an untroubled paradise, it was still at its core and in its highest bowers a civil place. No, the book was either a fiction or the ravings of a dim mind. Perhaps the postal clerk had had the right idea. Senlin pocketed the wife-monger's chapbook with a dismissive snort. It had been a productive morning. He had not relished lying to Ms. Olivette Burks, and certainly didn't like having the lie recorded on paper for all posterity. But he knew that raising the general alarm in Esau would do no good. If the townsfolk learned that Maria was missing, they might send a search party. Burks would certainly come. And then they would be plunged into the same chaotic mess that he and Maria had blundered into. God knows how many of them would be robbed, or detoured, or separated, or otherwise ruined in the turmoil of the market. No, it made no sense to add to the rolls of the lost. His only recourse was to find Maria on his own, and to return before their train tickets expired. He was returning to the Le Gris Hotel to renew his inquiry, when his attention was drawn to an amiable-looking crowd gathering about a waterside gazebo. An undecorated black banner hung from one white rail, like a long forked tongue. Believing that a troupe of actors was preparing a play, Senlin followed his curiosity to the edge of the gathering crowd. Two men occupied the gazebo stage. The foremost was a young man, perhaps 16 years old, dressed in the khaki apron common among hotel staff. Except for his anguished expression, he was quite a handsome youth, with thick, oil-black hair. Behind him, an unassuming, relatively diminutive man fiddled with his white linen shirt, distracted by what seemed a red spot near his cuff. His round gut and slight limbs gave him a frog-like appearance, and his wide mouth only added to this impression. A broad straw hat hid the rest of his face. Something in his smile disturbed Senlin. It was too fixed and straight, like the carved grimace of a gargoyle. "Has the show begun?" Senlin asked an old woman nearby, who was peeking and craning to improve her view. Her starched bonnet identified her as a laundry woman. She looked in his direction only long enough to toss her chin in disgust.
"Have some respect."
"I'm sorry. Are they celebrities?"
"What are you? Fresh off the barges?"
She gave him a second, more thorough look.
That's the pallbearer, the grim thresher himself. That's the Red Hand.
Senlin smiled at the woman's dramatic introduction of the actor. His face is grim enough. Who's the boy, then? She continued in a crusty whisper, eyes darting to their corners, hunting for her eavesdroppers.
A sinless nit. Works at the Moncapella Hotel. At least, he did. Poor Freddy.
A customs agent emerged from the crowd and climbed the first two steps of the gazebo. He began reading from a stiff sheet of stationery.
Mr. Frederick Haggard, you have been found guilty of theft, embezzlement, defamation, forgery, destruction of property.
The sentence went on and on for some moments. The counts against the young porter seemed impossibly, absurdly numerous. Senlin wondered what the meaning behind the farce might be.
Conspiracy against the Customs Bureau, assault, lewd conduct, trespassing, and rape.
Lies, hissed the laundry woman at his side. Freddy caught the eye of a rich old dame, and she tried to start a dally with him. Freddy fended her off, and she called the commissioner in to sort him out. There's the sorting.
Does the condemned wish to repent?
The agent, coward that he was, faced resolutely away from the handsome youth. It dawned on Senlin that this was not a play. He had stumbled upon an execution. In a voice hardly loud enough for Senlin to hear, the youth said,
I want to see my mother.
It was a pitiful and honest utterance. Even without knowing the first detail of the boy's life, Senlin felt certain he was witnessing a terrible injustice. Senlin wanted to cry out, to rush the gazebo and pull down the black banner. But he had learned to be afraid of the customs agents, and now he was learning to be afraid of someone new. That man, what had she called him? The Red Hand. Something about him made Senlin tremble. Transfixed, he watched as the Red Hand rolled up one loose white sleeve, revealing a bronze band about his forearm. Fitted to the metal cuff were six vials, like the barrels of hypodermic needles, each filled with some sort of sloshing serum that glowed like lit-up rubies. Hat drooping over his face, the Red Hand turned a series of pegs on the brass cuff, like a musician tuning his instrument. The glowing serum drained from the cylinders and pushed into the Red Hand's veins. A gargling cry, like something from a slaughterhouse, escaped the Red Hand's mouth, and for a moment Senlin wondered if the man hadn't wounded himself. Then he raised his right hand above his head, and the crowd gasped at the luminous red tracery of veins glowing beneath the skin of his palm and arm, shooting out from the bronze brace like roots. The radiant line speared up his shoulder, showing through his clothes like a wound seeping through a bandage. Soon, the right half of his torso glowed red. The Red Hand's posture became apish. Every rope and thread of muscle pressed to the surface. He circled the boy, now chattering with fear, pleading still to see his mother. Before anyone was prepared for it, the Red Hand leapt at the youth from behind. With the astonishing dexterity of an acrobat, he scaled the boy's back and dug one foot into either shoulder. The boy, staggering a little under the unexpected and awkward weight of the Red Hand, hardly had time to cry out before the executioner bent, placed his hands under the boy's jaw, and wrenched himself straight, carrying the boy's beautiful head from his neck. Blood leapt into the air. The unnatural two-man tower collapsed. Senlin turned away, too late, his stomach convulsing, and was sick at the cleaning woman's feet. A short distance behind the gazebo, swimmers floated on their backs in the spangling waters of the reservoir. Chapter 4. Conversations are a tedious symptom of an empty dance card. Every Man's Guide to the Tower of Babel. Senlin wandered the shimmering streets, hypnotized by the horror he'd witnessed. Though he hardly realized it, his steps were not without motive. He was searching for some sign of redemption, some hint that the human animal was not only horrible and violent. He needed some encouraging polemic, some cultural accomplishment or artistic ideal. His search drew him to the open shutters of a music hall, and he stood for some minutes listening to the lively play of a string quintet. But what might have sounded like a tuneful refrain an hour ago now sounded like frivolous sawing. Uncured, he meandered toward a romantic fresco of three maids, enlaced with ribbons and primroses. Their expressions were both ecstatic and innocent. Their arms and legs were plump, and yet apparently weightless. The virgins floated and smiled, exuding an erotic sap that made him feel wretched and alone. A group of young children played on the sidewalk. Hoping to hear some naive expression that would fill him with wistfulness for his students back home, Senlin slowed as he passed them. The children were playing hopscotch on a freshly chalked board. Balancing on first one foot, then the other, a young girl recited a nursery rhyme as she hopped. He had never heard the rhyme before, and, as is sometimes the case with such minor discoveries, this new-to-him, old-to-the-world verse seemed to have been written especially for him. The tower grows up, the tower grows down, the tower holds up the hollow ground. The hot falls up, the hot falls down, the hot fills up the hollow ground. The simple verse was sung out happily again and again to the rhythmic stamp of the child's leather slippers. Senlin pressed one finger to his ear, as if to keep the song and its morbid vision from lodging there. He hurried his step. He went in search of Taru and the consolation of wine. Finding his friend at Café Riso, Senlin imposed himself. He gulped from Taru's glass when his own was too slow to arrive, and heatedly recounted the execution he'd witnessed. The words poured from him like a lecture that threatened to become a rage.
How can we tolerate such savagery? I thought the tower was a moral pillar, but what has it shown me? Torture, sham justice, and public murder. Monstrous men with glowing, bloody hands. Madmen and actors without conscience. This isn't the sink of humanity. It's the sewer. Oh, don't look at me like I'm snoring through another lesson, Taru. You know I'm right.
Unconsciously, Senlin had begun biting his fingernails, his teeth clicking together in sharp little snaps.
Quit biting your nails, Taru said.
I'm not biting my nails. I'm trimming them with my teeth, because I've lost my nail clippers, along with everything else, Senlin said, swatting uselessly at the coins of reflected light that flared across his face.
He almost revealed the extent of what he had lost, but stopped himself.
And better my nails than your head.
Taru reared back in mock fright, raising his hands to shield his face.
Heaven protect me from the spring cleaning of a man's conscience. Don't see that me, headmaster. I'm glad your self-righteousness has given you some exercise, but you forget. We are not such a tidy, reasonable, and humane race. Our thoughts don't stand in grammatical rows. Our hearts don't draw equations. Our consciences don't have the benefit of historians whispering the answers to us. Oh, stuff your outrage.
Anyone happening past their corner of the patio would never have imagined the two were friends.
You overlook the beautiful and exaggerate the evil.
You didn't see what the Commissioner's circus did to that boy. His head...
Speaking through a clamped jaw, Taru's voice lowered.
The Red Hand is a ghoul, I give you that. And no, I can't tell you the first thing about why he glows or how he gets his strength. It doesn't matter. He's just a bugbear for your nightmares.
Taru, quick as a spark, reached across the table and clapped his broad hand over Senlin's wrist, nearly upsetting Senlin's newly delivered glass of wine. His voice was hoarse but forceful.
But you would do well to speak more quietly about the Commissioner's sins. His ears are everywhere. There are men who would welcome a revolution, but we are few.
Then why don't you just leave?
Senlin said, with disarming honesty, peeling Taru's hand from his arm. Taru looked as if he'd been pricked.
Of course I am. In the morning.
I need another glass before I dive after that little fable, Senlin said.
Despite the gruesome execution, despite his hopeless, floundering search for Maria, despite the Hods and the vindictive commissioner, Senlin felt a glimmer of peace. Their argument and the wine had given him what he had